Podcast, Monday, November 21st, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I'm sitting here and I'm perusing over the show notes and looking at all of the stuff that we actually have to talk about this week. There's lots of things going on. There's a few extra days in there. I know that. But every week when I think we're going to sort of run out of things to talk about, it turns out there's still a number of things going on. We have an update on Apple actually talking with McLaren. We'll give you all the details on that. The reviews and comments and things related to the new Touch Bar MacBook Pros are coming in, and we'll discuss what everybody's talking about related to the new machines. Also, Ming-Chi Kuo, our friend and analyst, is making some predictions about iPhone sales for 2016, plus we have updates on what might be next for the iPhone, also what's happening with AirPods, some Apple TV stuff to talk about, also what's going on with Apple and augmented reality. There's a potential really cool new product maybe coming from Apple. Just when we thought there was going to be no new Apple hardware this week, Apple came out with another product. We'll get into that. Also, some sad news related to Apple and automation. New Apple Store maybe going in down under. Apple cleaning out the App Store. Security concerns over your call logs on your iOS devices. Updates to some of Apple's repair programs. And also, Apple may be discontinuing a product, and you may be a little bit sad about that. So all of that just in the news. And then, of course, we've got some tips and tricks and some of your feedback to get to, some questions. We're going to dive into all of that in just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk to you about PDF Pen. You know, PDF Pen, it is your Swiss Army knife for working with PDFs on all of your devices. And I can tell you, for me, all of my Macs, all of my iOS devices, if you were to pick up any one of them, you would see I have a copy of PDF Pen Pro on there. And it's not just because Smile is a sponsor. I actually owned PDF Pen Pro long before they did that. And the reason is because we all have to work with PDFs. They're like the standard document format that you're going to run across day to day, day in and day out. And if you need to manipulate anything, if you have any kind of workflow related to PDFs, PDF Pen is the tool that is going to get you covered. Editing and annotation, no problem. That's built-in stuff, pretty straightforward. Filling out and signing forms, plus OCR. If you need to search a PDF, if you need to find stuff, I use it for signing documents all the time. Also, filling in PDFs that are even what I call fake forms, right? They're the PDF that you get and it doesn't have fill-in fields. Of course, you can add those with PDF Pen Pro if you want to do that. Or you can just simply put text right on top of that. You need to redact or, you know, add security to parts of your documents, it can do that too. You want to export to Word, you want to put in page numbering, even handling things like the fancy Bates numbering, it'll do all of that. And then PDF Pen Pro takes things even further. You can, like I said, do the fill-in forms, you can create interactive PDF forms, you can build a table of contents, set document permissions, convert websites to PDFs, multi-page PDFs. If you have an entire site that you maybe want to convert to a PDF and take that offline for reading, it'll also let you easily edit the OCR text from your scanned documents if you have PDF Pen Pro. And if you want to export to Microsoft Excel, Microsoft PowerPoint, or create PDF archive formats, it'll do all of that. And plus, you can keep all of your PDFs in sync across all your devices because it has iCloud or Dropbox syncing. PDF Pen Pro can handle it all with ease. And plus, right now, here's a deal for you. Get 20% off a new PDF Pen Pro license. Just visit smilesoftware.com/Maccast. You'll get the discount and all of the details. Plus, their website's great. Check out their blog. It's got great tips and tricks for all of the Smiles products. And on the website, you can get videos and great information learn how to use and master PDF Pen Pro. So if you don't have a copy, grab it now because you get 20% off. SmileSoftware.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the show. You remember back in September when there were those heavy rumors that Apple might be in talks to buy the luxury sports car maker McLaren? It was supposedly to help fuel their car efforts, the Apple Titan car project. A lot of us kind of made fun of this rumor. We thought, no way, that's insane. It's kind of crazy. Apple wouldn't be doing that. Well, this week, the CEO of McLaren, Mike Fluitt, told Reuters in an interview that Apple did indeed visit the company and talk to them about what they did, but Apple never actually formally made a bid to buy the company. So, you know, sometimes when there's smoke, there's just smoke, maybe not fire, like a lot of people want to jump to. But, you know, at the time, rumors were claiming that Apple had begun negotiations to actually buy McLaren for between $1 billion and £1.5 billion. That's about $1.3 to $2 billion U.S. So the price point was kind of high. Because Apple had the car project going on, it wasn't totally out of the realm of the possibility. But, yeah, it seemed a little bit crazy. Apple and McLaren back then, or McLaren rather, Apple doesn't really comment on this stuff. McLaren back then said it was not negotiating with Apple for a purchase, and that seems to be true. It also made it seem at the time like no meetings took place, but at least we know now that Apple was speaking with McLaren. I think typically they do this a lot. They will go talk to other companies that they respect and in industries that maybe they're looking at for potential future expansion and just try to get a rough idea about what they do, how they do things. And, you know, being a high-end car maker, McLaren would have been a good choice, I think, for Apple to take a look at how they build things, how they do things, that sort of stuff. So that's probably all that was going on at the time. Of course, the rumor mill here is, hey, there's Apple executives at McLaren, and immediately jumps to, oh, maybe they're going to do a buyout. And that's not always, and actually probably more often not the case when Apple's out talking to different companies. But still, a little bit of truth behind that rumor. Reviews of Apple's new notebook, the MacBook Pro Touch Bar Edition, are starting to come out. That's because they finally got them out to customers. They're slowly trickling out, and actually more and more people are getting them in their hands. And so far, I have to say that the reviews have generally been pretty positive. And also on the sort of negative side of things, a lot of the comments are likely what you'd expect. Overall, kind of what we're hearing is that it is a great machine, awesome design. Everybody really loves the design, the quality, the thinness, the weight are all very positive things. Yes, they all tend to agree it's a little bit more on the expensive side when you compare it to prior models. Apple did raise the price. That's just a fact, the base prices at least. And compared to last year's processors, this year's technology is not that much further advanced, right? It's using kind of older processors. Really, the processors that Apple would like to use from Intel aren't ready yet. They're not going to be ready probably till sometime in the first quarter. So they opted to go not with the kind of lower end Kaby Lake processors that are more targeted at like convertibles and machines like the MacBook Air. They went with the appropriate Skylake processors for this year's model. Yeah, they upped the graphics and the GPUs in terms of using the Polaris chips, and a lot of people are commenting that was a good choice. And again, people are finding performance-wise, it's not a vast improvement, but it is an improvement over the prior generation. And the package as a whole, and I think this is what's really important, is really, really great. It's a solid upgrade for the MacBook Pro, even if it isn't the greatest upgrade that everybody was really, really hoping for, especially after a little bit longer time between upgrade cycles. In general, they're kind of saying it's worth the upgrade if you're coming from a machine that's older than, say, a 2013 model. I would almost say even if you have anything a little bit later than that. But if you're running a newer model, something like the 2015 edition, yeah, you're not going to get a huge performance upgrade. But really, something that I'm not seeing in the reviews that I think you need to take into account is the architecture in terms of the SSDs and the RAM that is in there. So not just looking at the processor specs, the GPU specs, but also, again, that entire package. I think there's a little more performance in there than a lot of people are mentioning in their reviews. So I think, you know, if you're really power hungry, and even if you have a later model and you want to get the latest thing, I think it could be worthwhile for you. There's also a lot of grumbling about the USB-C ports in a number of the reviews that I'm reading. You know, the whole dongle thing, oh, we're going to have dongles. That is something that I think every couple years when we get a new connector, like when we went from FireWire to Thunderbolt or even FireWire 400, 800, we go through these transitions anytime there's kind of a new port standard. And I think USB-C really is the future. It is, and Thunderbolt 3 for that matter. And it's going to be that way for a while. I think we're going to have that USB-C connector, but we're in this transitionary period. And I think I totally agree with Apple's decision to standardize on the single port, especially considering that it delivers, you know, power and all the different data standards, all the different things over a single connector. And I think in the long run, we're going to like that. Yeah, we're going to live in the year of dongles for probably the next year. But slowly and surely, as more hardware comes out that adopts the standard, those are going to go away and it's just going to be cables. And plus, I love the idea of the docks that are coming out now and being able to, especially with a notebook, if you're using it in a desktop configuration, to be able to bring it in and literally just plug in a single cable. If you get one of those new 5K or 4K displays, they've got all kinds of other connectors on the back. You can leave everything connected and just dock with that one cable. Yes, short term, there's going to be a little bit of pain, but I think we're going to get over that pretty quickly. And we've seen that with other technologies. The other thing that we can't discount and was sort of discounted, at least initially on the new MacBook Pro, I think, is the Touch Bar. You know, the Touch Bar is getting a lot of really good love in a lot of these reviews. People are getting their hands on it. They're able to finally use it. And a lot of them are really liking it a lot. Not everyone. You know, some people are a little bit critical. Some people still question, is this workflow going to be really something that makes sense, especially when you start getting into third-party apps? And the general consensus is that for a lot of applications, it is. And if it's implemented correctly and it's thought about how you would use it in your application, and I think smart developers are going to figure this out really, really quickly, I think it could be a really useful tool. And I'm seeing that based on the reviews. I haven't had a chance to try it out myself. I'm hoping to get into an Apple store. I think they have machines at select Apple stores throughout the country and maybe overseas right now. Hopefully, there'll be more in more retail stores as the weeks go on. But I'd love to get in and play around with it a little bit. But I'm warming up to the idea, and it seems like reviewers are liking it a lot as well. Now, one review pointed out something that I thought was very smart and I had not thought about, and that is that the Touch Bar is maybe not all that great if your main use case for a MacBook Pro is as a desktop machine. If you use a separate mouse, keyboard, or trackpad. And that's the configuration I have mine in. I use an iRiser stand, and so I don't even touch the trackpad or the keyboard on my MacBook Pro. So having that Touch Bar way up there isn't going to be very useful for me. So if you are planning on wanting to use the Touch Bar with your new machine, you may think about that before, you know, how is my usage? Am I going to use the laptop as my main display and keyboard on my desk with a separate monitor? Or if you're using something separate, we may have to wait and hope. I really hope Apple's going to do this. Hope that Apple brings out a version of the Magic Keyboard with a Touch Bar. I think if they do, it's going to be probably in the $200 to $300 range for that keyboard, probably more like $299, but I think it may be well worth it. And if you hadn't heard, I can't remember if I mentioned it last week, or we may have talked about this on the iOS show, but Red Sweater Software actually came out with an application called Touche, I think about a week or so ago, that will let you virtually run the Touch Bar on your Mac. I think I mentioned a GitHub project that you could go check out that created an app that you could download and install. Now, the same people who make Mars Edit, Red Sweater Software, have a version of this app. So you can grab that if you just want to play around with it on any Mac that's running the latest version of Mac OS Sierra. But, you know, the Touch Bar, I think it shows a lot of promise. Another thing that was mentioned in a couple of the reviews is that the Touch Bar does dim after about 60 seconds and turns off 15 seconds later to preserve battery life, so that you have to tap it to then wake it up. One thing I didn't notice in this review and I'm curious to find out is if you're switching, because it's contextually aware, as you go into different parts of an application, it generally brings up UI elements on the Touch Bar. I'm assuming when you change between screens, then it will come back up. I'm guessing the 60-second to 15-second turn-off thing is if you stay in any one mode for any given period of time. So, like, if you're messing around in the Finder, those controls might go away, but a simple tap on it will bring it right back to life, and you can see it. As far as why Apple went with the Touch Bar versus a full touchscreen Mac, there's been a lot of debate and conversation about that. Well, Phil Schiller told Stephen Levy in an interview that Apple did consider touchscreen notebook designs over the years, that many times they thought about it. They had their people go out and even mess around, try out the technology, try different concepts and things like that. And they just overall found the experience to be not optimal. And the reason being that with notebooks and desktops, we generally have a keyboard or a mouse connected. And what ended up happening was what he called kind of catering to the lowest common denominator. So you end up creating a touchscreen notebook that's not really a great touchscreen device, and a, you know, standard input notebook that the standard input isn't really that great. It's kind of this compromise between the two. And Apple really wanted to look at something that was going to bring touch to the notebook, but expand the experience, create a better experience. So he explained that the Touch Bar basically becomes this part-time touch experience on the Mac, and it expands on kind of the language that was created with the trackpad and gestures. So now you have some additional gestures and controls that are in that same plane with your trackpad and your keyboard, and that just made more logical sense for the form factor and pushed that forward, rather than sort of becoming this hybrid compromise between a touch experience and a notebook experience, or a touchscreen experience and a notebook experience. And I can see that, you know, that I kind of agree with. The biggest example I have is going back to my iPad Pro with the smart keyboard. And again, there, I think everything was really thought pretty well through. You know, how do we bring a keyboard into a tablet experience and make that work really, really well? And I think Schiller points out in the interview too, talking about touch targets and things like that, even in the operating system itself. Whereas on a tablet, touch targets, the whole operating system is designed for touch. Whereas on a desktop, if you just add a touch screen, well, the OS still has to be modified. Things have to be changed a little bit. And when you change those things, then those changes may not be optimal for a pointer and keyboard experience. And if you're going to be switching between the two, then it just doesn't make sense. With the keyboard coming into the tablet, like on the iPad Pro, you still don't have a mouse or a pointer, which I think is the right thing to do, because you're going to use your finger. So the operating system kind of supports it. Even still there, though, the keyboard to screen experience has never been natural to me, and I think I mentioned this on the last show. So I think Apple's making the right choices and decisions here. I think they're thinking this through, and it just kind of pointed out in this interview that, yeah, Apple has tried these things. It's not like they just made a flippant decision to say, no, we're not going to do a touchscreen notebook. And I don't think it rules out the possibility that in the future they might not figure it out. They might figure out an experience that does work. It's just not here now with this first iteration. And the Touch Bar may be a small step in that direction. Whether we end up there or not, I don't know. I kind of think that we won't, because I think we're going to get to screenless interfaces long before it makes sense to do this kind of touchscreen notebook sort of experience. And we'll talk a little bit more on that later when we get into AR. We've also gotten to the point where now that these are in people's hands, the teardowns are happening. We're finding out more about what makes these things tick. If you remember, we had a teardown of the non-Touch Bar edition, and it kind of had some exciting news because it looked like it was going to have, these models might have removable SSDs or replaceable SSDs. The non-Touch Bar model does. It's still a kind of a proprietary daughter card connector, but it opens up the possibility for someone like OWC to actually create a aftermarket SSD for these machines. Unfortunately, it's looking like the Touch Bar models do not have that. They have the storage soldered on the motherboard, probably in a lot of ways for the performance reasons, you know, to get the speed and the performance out of the system that Apple is achieving. It makes sense to have that soldered onto the motherboard. It also seems like they have less battery capacity. The batteries are about 25% smaller. You still have the same rated battery life according to the specs, but a little bit smaller. And that opened up room for some other things, I think, like the speaker system. The oddest thing, though, is that speaker system, because it was noted that the speaker grills that are on the top case don't line up exactly with the placement of the actual speakers inside the machine. And at first, iFixit thought that the holes didn't even go all the way through, that they were purely cosmetic. Well, it turns out that some of them don't. Some of them are cosmetic, but there are holes, and it seems like there is maybe some baffling or some channeling that allows the tweeter sound to come out through the top speakers, but lower bass sounds are likely coming out through some of the other side vents and things like that. So it's kind of an interesting discovery. You lift off the top case and where all the speaker grill holes are, the speakers don't line up with, and it didn't make sense at first. So they had to do a little bit of investigating on that. The other thing that they noted was that the Touch ID sensor, it does pair up with the new T1 chip that is on the logic board, meaning that if you need to do a replacement of the Touch ID sensor, you're probably also going to have to replace the logic board as well. Those are paired up at the factory, and they need to match up for the security technology to work. Overall, they gave it, and I think this wasn't surprising, a repairability score of 1 out of 10. So if you think you're going to get into your new MacBook Pro to do anything, probably think again. Batteries are glued in. The Touch Bar was actually very difficult for them to remove. As a matter of fact, I think they damaged it, separated the digitizer from the LCD during their teardown process. A lot of glue everywhere in this thing, and there's just not a lot of space and a lot of things to work with. And there's not any really consumer replaceable parts in there. So you really don't need to get in there, or aren't going to have to get in there to do anything. If you need a repair, you're going to be taking this to Apple or to an Apple authorized repair center. Some odd things then came out as people started receiving these machines too. We're starting to hear about some of the little early problems. You know, anytime there's a major new redesign in a system, you can expect there's going to be a little hiccups and bumps both in software and in hardware. But one really odd thing that started showing up, I think on Twitter, developer Stephen Trotten-Smith pointed this out. I think it was pointed out by someone else. But they were noticing that some of the systems were arriving without Apple's system integrity protection SIP turned on. It was actually turned off on the device. And if you have a new machine, you can check your system by going into the terminal and running the command CSRUtil. So CSRUtil space and then the word status. You hit return and it should tell you that system integrity protection is enabled. If you find that it is disabled, you can re-enable it, but you're going to have to boot into recovery mode. So reboot your Mac holding down the command plus R key at startup. And then when you get into recovery mode, go under the utilities menu, launch the terminal, and then you can enter the command CSRUtil enable. So CSRUtil space enable. And then that should turn system integrity protection back on. You'll have to restart the machine. And after it reboots, you'll want to run that CSRUtil status command just to make sure that it is enabled. It should be turned on because it's a big part of the system that protects you from hacking. It basically doesn't allow apps or anything to go in and mess with a lot of the underlying system and protects you from that. So you want to have that turned on. There have also been some reports of people having issues with the new trackpad and specifically the three-finger drag gestures. They are not working for some people on that new trackpad, and it does have that big new ginormous trackpad. So hopefully that's just a software thing, something that Apple will be able to address with a future software update. Another thing that's looking like a small software issue, and it's more just a visual issue than anything else, is a number of people noticed in the system information panel that OS X, Mac OS Sierra was misidentifying the GPU on the models with the Intel HD 580 chip. It was actually reporting that, or 530 chip rather, it was reporting that it was an Intel Iris Pro 580, which is a much beefier chip and you would hope was in there, but unfortunately, again, it seems to be just a software bug, a bug in the data in the system information app, and it will likely get corrected soon. One other thing that was noted by Apple Insider is there are some reports from users who are using the new machines with Boot Camp to run Windows that they are getting audio issues that could potentially be causing permanent damage to the speaker system. What's happening is when they're running Windows under Boot Camp, they're getting a periodic loud pop from the speakers, and it seems like if that runs long enough, it can actually potentially damage the system. It's limited to Windows running under Boot Camp, so it's not happening if you're running Windows in Parallels or some other VM on the Mac side of things. And as far as anybody can tell, the issue might be related to out-of-date Windows audio drivers. The damage, if it does happen to you, appears to persist regardless of what OS you reboot into, and how it manifests itself is in imbalances between the speakers, so imbalanced audio between the left and right speakers, and some say that they get distortion once the volume starts going over 50%. So Apple has asked if you have noticed this issue that you report it to them, so let them know, call up Apple support and tell them about the issues that you're having. Until it's actually confirmed, and if it is an issue, until there is a fix out, if you do need to run Windows under Boot Camp, you probably want to plug in a set of headphones or turn the speakers off so that you don't have audio, or turn them down so you don't have audio coming out of the speakers, and that should keep you protected. But apparently Apple should be looking into that, and hopefully you're not one of these people who got their speakers damaged by this issue. But again, overall, MacBook Pros reviews seem to be pretty positive. I'm excited to go check one out. If you do have one, if you have one of these new machines and you want to weigh in with your comments, your thoughts, your initial impressions, what you think here on the show, shoot me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that iPhone shipments for 2016 have now peaked, and he's actually declining, saying he's seeing declines between 5% and 15% for shipments in November and December. That's enough to have him adjust his sales estimates to between 70 to 75 million units for the last two quarters of the year. And that's lower than other predictions by about 10 million units. So he thinks things are slowing down, particularly because of China and competition from some of the other cheaper models there. And then he also mentions the threat of future import tariffs under President-elect Trump as potentially being something that's slowing iPhone sales in China, and that's impacting overall sales here for the end of the year. Still, sales have been going strong, and there are others that aren't necessarily agreeing with Kuo. Consumer Intelligence Partners data shows that the iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus adoption rates have actually outpaced the adoption rates of the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus during the first month of sales. So it's doing better than last year's models of iPhones, but still did not outpace the iPhone 6 or 6S or 6 Plus sales, rather. And that was, again, kind of to be expected. They also noted that Android to iPhone switchers are up this year with this year's model from 12% to 17%, so 5% higher. And I'm assuming some of that may be related to the whole Samsung Galaxy Note Fire issue a little bit, although it was noted in another report that many consumers, actually Android phones benefited a little bit more from that, with many consumers moving to some of the lower priced, lower cost Android phones. And the slower numbers still haven't stopped Kuo from making his predictions for 2017, for the 2017 version of the iPhone. He's saying that next year we can expect three models from Apple, a 4.7 inch, a 5.5 inch, and a premium, what's looking now to be a 5.8 inch model. He claims that the two base models are going to be basically the same in terms of the design and form factor, just with updated specs, and it will still have a TFT LCD screen in both the 4.7 and 5.5 inch models. He claims only the highest end model, the 5.8, will get the all new industrial design that we've been hearing about, this glass front and glass back design with an OLED display. He's saying it's going to be a 5.8 inch display, a curved panel from Samsung, but will actually only have an active area of 5.1 to 5.2 inches. I was a little confused on this point. The assumption seems to be that the non-active area of the screen would actually wrap around the edge of the device. What's not clear to me is that going to be an active display area? So we know it's not going to be an active touch area, but is there going to be information or something displayed in that area? And I guess only Apple knows that at this point. It certainly seems like it would have the ability to do that. I don't know if they'd try to do like the Samsung Edge sort of thing where you've got information being displayed on the edge of the display. Kuo also thinks that only the larger premium version of the phone is going to feature Apple's dual lens camera system, though it is believed that dual lens cameras could be coming to all iPhones as standard issue by 2018. That news is a little bit of a disappointment to me, and I'm hoping that this early in the game, it's just something that Apple is kind of exploring. I'm really hopeful that the dual lens will actually trickle down next year into all models of the iPhone. But right now, that's not what we're hearing in the rumor mill. Other rumored features for next year's iPhone include an in-screen home button and touch ID sensor. So that would actually be integrated right into the display, at least according to some reports. There is some dissent on that. Not everybody is agreeing on that rumor. But this idea of an almost bezel-less designed, at least for, again, the redesigned model, if it turns out there's only that one high-end model that's redesigned with the all-glass with a stainless steel frame and edging, then, you know, that's sort of how that's going to turn out. Again, that's not news that I'm particularly excited about, especially being a guy who really likes the 5-inch version of the iPhone. I don't really relish having to stick with last year's design just because I don't want a gigantophone, right? But I may be moving back to the larger size, at least if I want the new design next year. Hoping that's not the case, but looking like that at this point. In the future, at least some iPhones could be designed in California, but also made in America too. The Japanese site Nikkei says that Foxconn has been studying the possibility of moving some iPhone production to the United States. Now, Apple actually reportedly asked both Foxconn and Pegatron, their two main iPhone suppliers, to look into the possibility of doing manufacturing in the U.S., but Pegatron declined. Foxconn entertained Apple's idea, but noted that it would be a logistical challenge, especially since a lot of the component suppliers are largely in Asia. So the proximity of that really helps with iPhone production, and moving everything to the U.S. would pose a pretty big challenge. But they're at least entertaining and looking at the idea. Apple has been looking at it as well, and I guess pressuring some of their manufacturers or their main manufacturers to actually look at the viability of that. Whether or not it will happen at any point in the future remains to be seen. Again, given the political situation in the U.S., there could be some pressure put on by certain people to actually make that happen. Again, only time will tell. I hate getting into anything political on this show. You know that, but it's worth noting that this is actually something that Apple is looking into and is being considered, regardless of any other kind of political or outside pressures. AirPods, where art thou? What is happening with Apple's AirPods? They promised them to us in October and then said, nope, we're not going to quite make it there. They're going to be coming soon. We haven't gotten any official reports, although that hasn't stopped the rumor mill from guessing. We've been hearing all kinds of rumors from they're going to be here at the end of November. All the way through, we'll see them in 2017. Supply chain checks seem to be indicating that Apple's looking to begin production on the AirPods sometime in December. If that is really the case, you can imagine that we're not going to be able to purchase them till sometime next year. That would be disappointing, but at this point, to me, that looks like the most viable rumor. A lot of the other rumors are coming out of various retailers and online sellers and things like that. They all seem to be a little bit more positive, saying we could see them arrive in November or December. But as I think I alluded to on the last episode of the MacCast, this is sort of like you go into a Best Buy or a retail chain and you ask the guy on the floor and he just says, oh, yeah, I had heard or I think we're going to be getting those in next week. And then the blogs and other sites run with that as if it were some sort of factual rumor based on anything other than conjecture. And it really, really isn't. The supply chain checks, again, not 100% reliable, but tend to be a little bit more reliable. I mean, the bottom line is on this, though, in a year where we have not had a ton of new Apple products released and where Tim Cook came out on a stage at a keynote and said, hey, we're going to have these things on October. This whole thing looks like a big, giant mess, right? It's a little bit of egg on Apple's face for not getting this out. I'm all for them making sure that when they do release the product, it works as advertised and is great and is the perfect experience. So if that's what's going on, if they need extra time to make sure that this is working, great. If they need extra time to make sure that there's enough supply in the supply chain, that they're not going to be sold out everywhere and we're not going to have another, you know, Apple Pencil on our hands, great. And I think that's likely what's going on here. They want to make sure that everything's ready to go and it's perfect when they launch them. And it's the right thing, as frustrating as it is for those of us who would like to actually buy the product. Another thing that was shown off in that same keynote where Apple launched or announced the AirPods, rather, was the new TVO app that was going to come to iOS and also tvOS. And the latest beta of iOS, iOS 10 Beta 3, apparently has the TV app in it. And not only that, it looks like they've completely removed the video app and videos app, rather, and that is replaced by the TV app. Now, in iOS 10.2 Beta 2, both apps were in there, the TV app and the videos app. But now, with this latest update, videos is gone. The app is currently and will be at launch US only. So presumably outside the US, the videos app should remain on devices, but slowly but surely it will be replaced apparently by the TV app. It's not clear at this point what is going to happen with home videos, because those don't really fall under the TV category. They do not currently have a spot in the new TV app, at least according to reports. Maybe I would guess they would move into the Photos app along with your other videos that you would take on your iPhone or sync into Photos. That seems the logical place for them to wind up, but it's not clear at this point. But the new TV app, it's actually really pretty cool. It gives you this new Now Playing section, and in there it shows the movies and TV shows that you are currently watching anywhere on any other app that you have on your device that supports the new TV app. At the moment, those are Hulu, HBO, Showtime, Stars, and the CW, but we can expect that more apps will come on board with this. The recommendations, what I am most excited about is the fact that the recommendations are based on the apps and services that you are currently using. So if I go in and I have HBO and Showtime and Stars, and those are the things that I have access to, it's going to show me the shows that I'm currently watching. I can pick back up and watch additional episodes or additional shows, but it's also going to recommend to me movies and TV shows that are on just those services. And they're things that I can immediately then tap on, jump right into, and begin watching. And to me, that's really exciting. That kind of really changes the experience. You also, in the new TV app, have all of your iTunes purchases. So your purchased iTunes movies and your purchased iTunes TV shows, along with, I think, home sharing, although I've been playing around with this a little bit, and I can't get the home sharing to show up on my version of the iOS app, which I'm running on my iPad Pro. But I think part of that issue might be the fact that I am not running the current betas of macOS Sierra. I'm actually not running macOS Sierra at all. So it may be related to that, and that could be why I'm not seeing that. But as far as the TV app goes, I think my biggest issue or my biggest concern about the new TV app will be Apple getting commitment from some of the other channels and some of the other providers. I think it only works really, really well if they can get a lot of the most popular providers on board. And right now, two of the most popular providers aren't on board, and that would be Netflix and, of course, Amazon. Amazon doesn't even support the Apple TV at all right now. So I think Apple really needs to work on this. We did get a little bit of news this week that seems like it might be a push in the right direction and maybe a little olive branch that Apple's extending to try and get more video content and more channels on board. This comes from a Bloomberg report. They're saying that Apple is planning on cutting their fees for in-app streaming apps on purchases. So if you have a streaming app and you have a subscription service, right now, if you want to sell that through your app, you have to give Apple its 30% cut of the fee. Apple did last year change those terms to where if you get a new subscriber and they re-up, so after the first year, so in the first year, first sign up, they take 30%. In the second year, they would take 15%. Now, this new report from Bloomberg says Apple is looking to cut the fee to 15% for streaming apps for in-app purchases. So they're going to have the rate, and hopefully that will help some of the providers come on board. Some of them already had this negotiated rate with Apple. They had already done that individually, and as a matter of fact, I think Netflix is in that group. I think they're rumored to only be paying the 15% fee on in-app subscription service subscription fees. So, you know, it still may or may not be enough to get Amazon on board. I think, you know, part of their issue on the Apple TV, because they do have the iOS app, I think on the Apple TV, part of the issue is they can't send people to a web browser on the Apple TV to purchase direct from Amazon so that they don't have to pay the cut to Apple. And I think that's a big sticking point. So will they be able to get over that hurdle at some point? I don't know. I really hope Apple would be working hard to negotiate with Amazon and Netflix to get them as part of this new TV app experience, because I think it really is a good experience. Another thing that's being added with the new TVO app, at least in the beta, is we're starting to see the single sign-on feature that Apple had promised back at WWDC. It's somewhat limited at this point, I think mainly to DirecTV and one other satellite provider. But hopefully, again, this is the, you know, sort of pebble starting down the hill that will build up steam and snowball and become, you know, everybody jumping on board. Another kind of cool thing about the new TV app on the Apple TV is that you can change and reassign the TV button so that when you press it, it now will automatically launch the TV app and put you right into that now playing interface so you can get access to all of your stuff. And so if you can't tell, I'm pretty excited about the new TV app coming to iOS and Apple TV. And I think that will happen this year. I think they said in December we should see that. As far as Apple's overall TV strategy, there does seem to be some confusion in Hollywood as to what is going on. We've been hearing a lot of different rumors. You know, is Apple going to do its own content? Are they just going to rely on content from other providers? What's going on? Last week, we heard that Apple was supposedly in talks at one point with Chris Rock to do an exclusive video deal for a couple of specials. But they supposedly at some point just walked away and the content was actually picked up by Netflix. And, you know, Apple does continue to try and land exclusive like movie and early release deals for iTunes. I think they just got Michael Moore's Trump Land and a few other things where they have exclusive for a week or two, kind of like the same sort of thing they do with albums on iTunes Music. But as far as developing any kind of original content or programming, it really seems like now Apple has completely abandoned that strategy. It seems like maybe at one point they were kind of entertaining it. They were walking around talking to a lot of people like Chris Rock about creating that stuff. But now, for at least the Apple TV iTunes side, it doesn't seem like that's going on. They're still doing that, though, over on the Apple Music side. And as a matter of fact, Apple did secure the exclusive digital streaming rights to a 2014 documentary about the Roland TR-808 programmable drum machine. It's simply titled 808. Apple ran a trailer recently on its Beats One YouTube channel and does plan to air the documentary starting on December 9th. So you'll be able to watch it exclusively through Apple Music. The documentary is narrated by Beats One DJ Zane Lowe, and it actually looks pretty cool. So Apple doing some things on the Apple Music side, but as far as, you know, original content for Apple TV specifically, it's not looking like they're moving down that road. At one point, maybe they were, but we're not hearing that in the rumors. I'm hoping, again, Apple really starts to work harder with some of the other content providers like Netflix, HBO, and others to kind of get more of that content on Apple TV. I think if they're going to be successful in that space, that's what they're going to have to do. Barring that, I think they will ultimately at some point maybe have to turn to original content and programming. They certainly have the resources to do it. I think it's just not in their wheelhouse, and I think it's just an area they don't want to dive into at this point, because then you're competing with Amazon and Netflix and Hulu and all these other players that are coming on board. And that just seems like a game that, you know, I don't think Apple wants to get into. A game that Apple is likely to get into is augmented reality. And Bloomberg this week is reporting that Apple is in the exploration phase of looking at augmented reality glasses that would wirelessly connect to the iPhone. The system supposedly would be able to show images and other information in the user's field of vision and might incorporate augmented reality. So it'd be information display and then also potentially augmented reality layered on top of that. Tim Cook has said many, many times over the past year that Apple is very interested in augmented reality technology, much more interested in that than VR technology. I don't think that rules out the potential of Apple doing anything in VR, but they seem strongly focused in the augmented reality realm. The report also claims that Apple has been speaking to potential suppliers and has even ordered some near-eye displays for testing. So that seems to indicate that they're moving beyond the exploration phase and maybe into an early prototyping phase for some kinds of devices. They claim that if Apple does determine that this is a viable product or project moving forward, that it wouldn't be available until sometime in 2018 at the earliest. Now, you may be thinking exactly what I was thinking when I was reading this report, you know, considering how well Google Glass went over. I don't know how much better I'd expect Apple to do or if this experiment is going to bear much fruit. Now, if the focus is more on the augmented reality applications, then maybe. I think part of Google Glass's problem was the camera system and kind of the two-way system. If this was mainly, you know, information overlay facing on top of what you were doing, maybe it would be more publicly accepted. Also, design is going to play a big role in this. I think Google Glass, you know, the overall design was kind of goofy. So if Apple can make it, you know, more appealing on the fashion side of things, that could help. You know, we also do have to ask ourselves, and I think this is what Apple is looking into, you know, what does a screenless future look like where we don't look at our device screen, we interact with our devices and our technology in some other way? Voice is obviously a big part of that. We've talked many times here on the MacCast about, you know, voice first interfaces and what are those going to be like. You do need some ways to get information back that are maybe beyond audio, and some sort of heads up or augmented reality display could be the answer. Another thing, if you're, you know, more concerned about, you know, what do glasses look like, and, you know, not everybody maybe wants to wear glasses, there have been reports that Apple has been looking into a contact lens technology that could provide a display and augmented reality functionality right in a contact lens that would be right there on your eye. A little bit creepy, a little bit frightening, especially for people who don't like to wear contacts, but interesting nonetheless that the technology exists and is being developed. You know, in recent years, Apple has acquired a lot of companies in the AR and virtual reality space, including companies like PrimeSense and Mateo and Flyby Media. So they certainly are looking at these things in various ways and experimenting, and this is just more evidence of that. A separate Business Insider piece this week claimed that Apple was looking into building also some real-time object recognition technology for the camera app. So the idea here would be that it would help the AI image recognition that is in the Photos app now that Apple added with iOS 10. This is the thing that will allow it to go through, scan your photos, and find objects. This would be more in the spatial recognition context and mapping. So it would be happening in real time right inside the camera, the ability to kind of identify objects and people and things like that. And it could open up the possibility for Apple opening up image APIs with the camera system for other augmented reality-based applications. So this could become a really powerful part of the operating system that could help not only Apple's applications, but also third-party applications bring more augmented reality and more artificial intelligence-type things to the system. And that's pretty exciting and cool to think about. You know, the idea that it could not only recognize just objects and items and things like that, but could do that spatially, and that can help identify, you know, various objects in real time for something like an automated car driving system. So all of these technologies kind of play one into the other, and so any one given application you kind of have to step back from, I think, a little bit at this point and go, okay, Apple's going to build this into the camera app first, but what other applications does that have for potential future products and other things? And I think Apple's thinking about all of this stuff in the same way. So pretty exciting times, and I'm interested to see what Apple potentially does in the AR space. So now I have to admit, at the top of the show, I kind of alluded to the fact that Apple had some new hardware out here at the end of the year. And yeah, I tricked you a little bit. I'm talking about Apple's new book. And I'm not, this isn't a MacBook, it is an Apple book. It's 100% analog. It is hardware. It is a physical thing, but ink on paper book. It's called Designed by Apple in California, and it's actually an art book, 450 photos detailing Apple's products released from when Steve Jobs returned to Apple in 2009 through the present. Big, gorgeous, beautiful close-up photos of all of Apple's products, both externally and internally, all the details and stuff like that. It has a foreword and a dedication to Steve Jobs, but beyond that, that is the only text in this book. It comes in two sizes, a small version that's 10 inches by 13 inches and a large version that's 13 inches by 16 and a quarter inches. And it is not cheap. It's available online and through some of Apple's retail stores. The small version is $199 and the large version is $299. And it did cause a little bit of an uproar in the community this past week. I made some comments on it. You know, it is a thing, right? And art books tend to be expensive. This one is a little more on the pricey side, but, you know, that's not anything unusual for Apple. But in a year where we haven't seen a lot of actual Apple products, it does feel like the timing of putting this thing out is a little bit wrong. I think, you know, some people were a little bit upset by this, and I think rightfully so. But nothing wrong with Apple kind of tooting its own horn and showing off its design prowess with a really beautiful book. And if it's something you're interested in, you can buy it. I'm personally saving my money for the new EarPods, although I did point out that, you know, there is a big, beautiful picture of the EarPods. So if you'd like to spend $200 and get some EarPods this year, this looks like how you're going to have to do it. Well, at least a picture of some EarPods. Another bit of sad news that happened this week. This broke at the MacTech conference, which happened in Los Angeles this week, both from Andy Iannocco and Jeff Gamet. I saw both of them kind of report this when they were at the show. They noted that Sal Segoyan, who is the or was the product manager of automation technologies at Apple, has been let go from the company. He's no longer with Apple. He had been there for 20 years. He and his group were responsible for all of the automation services that are in iOS 10 that are in macOS And I think some of this stuff exists in iOS as well. But things like the Unix CLI, so shell scripting, Python, Ruby, Perl, system services, Apple events, including JavaScript and Apple Script, Objective-C, the scripting bridge, Automator, Apple Configurator, and application scripting and things like Photos and iWork and Finder, Mail, and all of the other Apple applications that support automation. Those were all under Sal's group and under Sal's realm. So this is kind of a big loss. He was told that the decision was being made simply for business reasons. There wasn't any kind of more clarification on that. Hopefully in the coming weeks, we'll get a little more detail as to what is going on here. But certainly the news was not great to hear in a year when many people are questioning Apple's commitment to the Mac and specifically the pro version of the Macintosh. These are, you know, scripting and automation is a big time pro feature. And to hear that Apple let go the guy that was in charge of the entire group and really championed those technologies inside Apple is, again, a little bit disturbing given the timing and sort of what else has happened. Now, a concerned customer did email Apple's head of software, Craig Federighi, and asked, you know, what's going on here? Are you guys getting out of the whole automation thing? I'm concerned about this. And he responded simply saying, quote, "We have every intent to continue our support for great automation technologies in macOS." Now, cynics among you might note, and I noticed this immediately, that he said continue to support, not develop new technologies. But I think that may be reading a little bit too much into it, at least at this early stage. We kind of have to see what happens. But Apple has been slowly and again, kind of quietly not updating those technologies as fast as they used to, or at least that's what it seems like. So, you know, are they getting out of this? Of course, we don't have great automation support in iOS. Third-party apps, great third-party apps like Workflow have kind of hacked their way or back-ended their way into giving us automation, and it's really pretty good. If you haven't tried out the Workflow app, you should check it out. But yeah, you know, again, in a year where there's not a lot of pro stuff happening, here's another little thing that gives you a little bit pause and a little bit of concern. But again, I'm willing to give Apple the benefit of the doubt and wait and see what they actually do. Melbourne may be finally getting an Apple store. Apple is close to finishing a deal for a new $50 million Apple store in Melbourne, Australia, in the downtown area. I guess they have some other stores supposedly somewhere near. Now, Australia is a big place, and I was trying to gain this, but the Apple Insider piece said they had three other stores in the Melbourne area, just not downtown, but I couldn't figure out which ones were really close by. This one is going to be the first one in Melbourne. Should it happen, negotiations have been reportedly going on for a long time and in secrecy. Part of the reason for the secrecy, I think, is the location of where the new store may be, which is Federation Square. That's the management company that Apple has been working with. One of the issues seems to be that Apple wants to build their classic design, you know, an all-glass standalone structure, and that would mean demolishing a building that's already there, the Yarra building. And it's not only the building that would have to go away, that building actually has some things in it. It has the Koori Heritage Trust, which has been there and is on currently on a lease that lasts 5 years, and they still have 4 years left on that lease. And the bottom floor, I guess, houses a pretty successful Italian restaurant. So what would happen to those two businesses should Apple get the go-ahead and should they put this new store in there? That remains to be seen. The other question is that the new Apple building wouldn't necessarily match this really unique postmodern design that all the other buildings currently at that square have. I guess there was some controversy over that design originally, but it's there now and it kind of has this look, and Apple wouldn't really fit in with that. So at this point, the rumors seem to indicate that things are moving forward and there's probably going to be a new Apple store at that location in Melbourne, Australia. We'll just have to see and wait until construction actually begins before we actually find out. And if you're in that area and you know a little bit more about the story, you want to give us a little bit more color on it, certainly send us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Apple said that they were going to be working to clean up old and outdated apps on the App Store, and it looks like they are moving forward on that promise. According to TechCrunch, and based on data from Sensor Tower, app removals actually went up on the App Store 238% in October. It's looking like Apple took down as many as 47,300 apps from the App Store in October. Now, most of them were in the games area, about 28%, followed by just about 9% in the entertainment and book categories, so 9% from each one of those categories. And then that was followed by education titles, 7% of those were removed, and 6% of the lifestyle apps were removed from the App Store in October. Apple is specifically targeting titles that they say are, quote, no longer function as intended, don't follow current review guidelines, or are outdated. Apple immediately removes any apps that crash on launch, but for the outdated apps, they are sending out notifications to the developers and telling them they have 30 days to update their apps or face removal from the App Store. And it looks like they are following through on that. So if you are a developer and you get one of those notices, if you have an app you haven't updated in a while, you're going to have to do something to get it updated. I think overall this is a good thing, but considering that there are 2 million plus apps on the App Store, that's as of June of this year, 47,000 apps seems like it would be hardly making a dent. But I guess if they, you know, if they remove 47,000, 50,000, 100,000 every month, we're going to get a pretty good way into cleaning up the App Store. And if you're concerned about one of your favorite old or outdated apps that you're still using, you may want to make sure that you grab a copy, you download it, and you make a backup of that so that you have your own copy should Apple ever remove it from the App Store. And if you just go into your iTunes folder, into the mobile applications folder, after downloading the app from iTunes, you want to make sure you go into the iTunes App Store and download the full app, because you remember a couple MacCasts back, we talked about the whole app thinning thing. When you download and install directly on your iOS device, you're not necessarily getting the full app. So you're going to want to do it through iTunes. Go into your iTunes folder, into the mobile application, your iTunes media folder, into the mobile applications folder, and you should find the .ipa files, the iPhone application files, in there. And that's the file that you're going to want to back up if you're concerned about this. A little bit of a security kerfuffle this week. A Russian security firm discovered that if you have an iPhone and you use iCloud Drive, that Apple uploads your call logs and stores them on their servers. They don't really mention this directly up front, and this is regardless of whether or not you are using iCloud backups on your device. The logs include both standard and FaceTime calls, along with missed call logs from third-party apps like Skype in iOS 10. Now, Apple doesn't keep the FaceTime logs over 30 days, the report noted, but the research firm did discover that they were able to recover data from call logs going back several months. So immediately, the internet, of course, because this is what the internet does, it starts freaking out and starts alleging that this is a violation of our privacy and it's a breach to our security and trust. And why is Apple doing this? We don't really understand it. And as usual, iMore and Rene Ritchie and his great team over there, they're the voice of sanity and reason. And they went straight to the source, talked to Apple, said, what's going on? Give us some details here. And what's going on is they do sync those log files, and it's so that they can get your missed call logs to sync across your devices. So if you get a phone call on your iPhone and you have it set up to integrate with your iPad and you can take calls on your iPad, when you go to your iPad, you can see the same missed call log. So it makes sense. Not only that, the data is completely encrypted using your passcode. So it is encrypted, and access to the data on iCloud requires having access to your iCloud ID and your password. So Apple recommends ensuring that you have strong passwords on your iCloud ID, and also that you enable two-factor authentication on your account if you're concerned about this, because without that, they can't get access to that call log information. Now, iMore also points out the fact that the call logs are part of the backup and that they are fully, it is fully disclosed in Apple's security white paper, which it is, that they do sync these log files. So it's right there. The security report itself claimed that the call logs are synced even if you have iCloud backups turned off, and that seems to be matching up with Apple's statement, you know, as to the reason as to why they want to do this. It's actually to sync the missing call logs. So they're using iCloud to do that. And the main reason I'm telling you this is that I did see one kind of small point of distinction in the whole disclosure thing, because it is in the security white paper, but the security white paper is talking about iCloud backups. And once again, this seems to be synced even if you're not using iCloud for backing up your iPhone. So to me, there is a just small disconnect there on the disclosure point, but I don't see that as a real huge issue. Now, one other concern that I think is legitimate is that Apple right now currently holds the encryption key on your iCloud backups. So given the proper government or law enforcement orders, they could be compelled to turn over those call logs. But in reality, those call logs are available from your carrier, from some other places as well. So, you know, again, it's a minor security concern. If you really are concerned about it, you can stop the syncing of the data by turning off or disabling iCloud Drive, but that's really not feasible if you're using other iCloud Drive, you know, services. If you're using iCloud Drive for its other purposes, you may not want to turn that off. And again, once again, depending upon which source you're looking at, that may or may not stop the syncing entirely. So bottom line is, really what you should be doing is making sure that you have a good passcode on your device and that your iCloud ID and password are also very secure. And for an even better added layer of security, make sure you enable two-factor authentication on your account. And as we have heard also, this whole issue about Apple having the encryption key to the iCloud backups, Apple is considering and is looking at ways to make it so that that is no longer the case in the future, that they have end-to-end encryption on everything related to iCloud and your backups. And so I fully expect at some point that will move forward, and then this will be kind of become a really non-issue. Remember back when we heard about the iPhone 6S Plus touch disease? In case you don't, this was a report that came out a few months ago that a repair shop had found a large number of iPhone 6S Plus devices that were coming into their shop with this same issue, where it would start, the display would get kind of a gray bar, the touch screen would become kind of flaky, and it would start to fritz out and stuff like that. And it would get progressively worse over time until the display just kind of gave out and failed and didn't really work altogether. And in investigating it, what they found the issue to be was the display control chip would become basically desoldered from the motherboard. The chip would crack and it would lose its solder points, probably due to heat and flexing of the device. Not necessarily bending, but just repeated flexing. You know, if you put it in your pocket and it bent a little, it would eventually kind of pop those solder joints. And when they looked at, well, why is this happening on this specific model, the 6S Plus, where it wasn't happening on the 6 Plus, what they discovered was a small design change, and the newer model seems to lack some of the extra support that was directly behind the chip that was being impacted. And so they called this issue touch disease. At that point, Apple was pretty much made aware of it, and I think they began investigating. Well, this week we got some good news, because Apple confirmed the issue. They're not calling it touch disease, but they confirmed the issue, and they started up a special repair program. The bad news is that they say the issue is your fault. If you've suffered from this, they're saying that it is your fault, and that means that because it's consumer damage, you'll need to cough up $150 for the fix. They say after investigation, the cause is not the phone's design, but the issue is due to multiple drops of the device on a hard surface. So the device will be covered for a fee. If the device is in working order, other than, of course, the touchscreen and flickering issues, so the screen can't be cracked and or broken and the device needs to work, you can bring it in, and for $150, they will fix the issue. Okay, now I have to chime in with my opinion on this, because when I heard about this, this just seems wrong to me. Apple Insider noted back in August that this complaint, this touch disease complaint, accounted for almost 11% of an Apple Store's daily iPhone service volume. So a large number of devices were coming in with this specific issue. And that original repair shop, the one that coined the touch disease term, their investigation also showed, you know, started because there was a large number of these devices that they were seeing with this issue. I find it hard to believe that that many people are dropping their device that much to where it's causing this kind of problem. It just seems suspect to me. And even if it is due to dropping, that still then to me feels like an underlying design issue, especially considering that the old model in the same size did not have the problem. And Apple should know that, quote, you know, newsflash here, people drop their phones. It's gonna happen. Phones get dropped, and you probably want a device, especially at the prices that Apple sells iPhones for, that's robust enough to be able to survive drop tests. You know, this is a base, just like they would do to the screen. You know, they improve the screen over the years to get more and more robust. Here's a case where they had a design that apparently was working because we didn't have this problem before. Now we've got this new, you know, model with a slight design change where they've removed some supporting material in the area of this chip, and now we've got a problem. So to me, this feels like a design flaw, not necessarily a consumer problem, regardless of what Apple's thinking. But at this point, if you have the issue, be prepared. You're probably going to be asked to pay the fee. What's not clear to me at this point is if you still have AppleCare on your device, will Apple cover this? But again, typically AppleCare does not cover user damage. And the report and the page related to this issue on Apple's support forum seems to indicate that they feel this is user damage. So you have that. They did also announce a second repair program for the iPhone 6S. This is for ones that are experiencing unexpected shutdowns. The good news on this one is this is a free repair. Apple has determined that a very small number of iPhone 6S devices may unexpectedly shut down. They say it's not a safety issue, and it only affects a limited number of devices in a specific serial range. The devices were manufactured between September and October of 2015. So if you have one of those early model iPhones, you want to contact Apple either via phone or via a retail store or via an Apple authorized service provider if you are experiencing these unexpected shutdowns. They will check it out, see if you're in the range for replacement, and they will replace your battery in your device for free. If you had this issue and you already had your device repaired and paid for it, you can contact Apple about a possible refund. And the same thing goes for the touch disease thing. If you paid for your repair and it cost you more than $150, you want to contact Apple and see if they will do a reimbursement. And then finally in the news for today, sorry we have to end on another sad note, but Mark Gurman at Bloomberg is reporting that Apple apparently has disbanded its entire airport router team and notes that many of the former airport engineers are now working on other teams, including Apple TV development. So it's looking like at this point that Apple is getting out of the router business, and we probably will not expect to see any new airport hardware from Apple. The last airport hardware was actually updated in 2013. We haven't seen an update since then. So just like Apple getting out of the display market, it looks like they're getting out of this market as well. Apple Insider had noted back a couple months ago that Apple had stopped selling Airport Extremes and Time Capsules in a number of its U.S. retail stores, though they were still selling them and they were still available online. You could order them through Apple's online store. I think you still can. But if you're considering or thinking about buying an airport router, you probably want to pick that up now. there are some people that are wondering and holding out hope that, you know, maybe Apple is moving these people over to the Apple TV team because they're working on a media server or some sort of hub, maybe a HomeKit hub. That's something that I've wanted to see them do for years. Maybe that's a possibility, but as far as Apple doing routers anymore, I think we are at the end of an era. That's it. And to me, it sort of makes sense. You know, originally when Apple started doing the AirPort, I think it was back when they brought out the iBook, and it was one of the first devices to have Wi-Fi technology in it. So they needed something good and reliable that they could connect that to. So I think they got into the business because there was a lack of Wi-Fi devices for people to buy. And then, of course, over the years, the technology has advanced. Apple's kind of stuck with it, but I think it was just sort of, not for any great particular reason other than they had this product and they just wanted to continue to support it. But now that there's newer technologies coming on board, mesh networks and things like that, I think they're recognizing that, you know, we don't need to play in this space anymore, and we can maybe focus our engineers and our attention elsewhere on places that make a little bit more sense. So as sad as this news is, I can kind of understand why Apple would be getting out of this space. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is iMazing. Look, if you have an iOS device and you want to get in and you want to really look at what's in your backups, what's on that device, if you want to be able to manage and access that stuff, iMazing is the tool that you want because it lets you get in and manage the data, information, and backups that are on your iOS devices. And you can do some of that with iTunes, but what is great and better about iMazing is it really lets you get in much deeper and look at things in much more detail than iTunes does, and all without requiring any kind of jailbreak. There's no hacking or anything going on here. You can manage and interact with data from your messages, from your photos and videos, from your music apps, from your notes, contacts, voicemail, the call history, file system, backups. You can back up your voicemails. You can get at your call history, browse and peruse through that, get at all your notes. And they do it all with a very familiar Apple-like interface. It's been recently updated. It looks great. It allows you to work asynchronously with your data, so you can actually start a backup or a file transfer or something going on in one area of the app, do it in the background, and move on to working on other parts of your iOS files. And like I said, they even let you browse files that are inside your backups. So this is great for recovering app data from individual apps. You can even export and re-import some of that saved data. So I've used this for like recovering and restoring game data from different games when that wasn't part of any kind of online system or any other backup. So it's actually saved my saved my rear end on a couple of occasions. And you can, like I said, back up your messages or voicemails and things like that, so you can actually save space on your device. And best of all, you can try it out completely free. Just head to iMazing.com. And when you order the app, you can get 20% off if you use the coupon code MacCast. iMazing, iMazing.com. Check it out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Sometimes I think it's easy to forget about a basic feature that's built right into the operating system. That's why I was kind of happy this week when I ran across an article by Brian Chaffin over at the Mac Observer. He wrote up a quick tip, and I'll link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, to remind us all about the undo feature that's built right into iOS. You know, on the Mac, if you make a mistake and you need to undo something, almost everybody who's ever used a Mac can tell you Command Z, right? That's the keyboard shortcut for undo. It works in just about any application anywhere in the operating system. But what about on iOS? You know, it doesn't have a command key, so there is no Command Z. What do you do? Some apps do provide an undo button, but what if they don't have an undo button? Well, part of iOS's core is something called Shake to Undo. And I think when Apple launched the iPhone, or not many versions after the launch of the iPhone on iOS, Steve Jobs showed off this feature during one of the keynotes. I can't remember specifically which one, but you just shake the device and it will often undo in many applications the last thing that you just did. It's like the Command Z, the version of Command Z for, or the equivalent of Command Z on your iOS device. Does it work in all apps? No, but I've found actually it works in many of them. I think when Steve Jobs demoed the feature, he even kind of alluded to the fact that they got the idea from an Etch-a-Sketch, right? So just like on an Etch-a-Sketch, you make an error when you're drawing something, you shake it, it erases or it undoes the thing that you were doing. I do have to admit, I find it somewhat awkward now on larger devices. It made a lot of sense when you had an iPhone that was, you know, 3.5 inches, but with a 12.9 inch iPad Pro, you're grabbing both hands and you're kind of shaking. It feels weird, but it's still an option. And if you need to undo something, I mean, what else are you going to do? Now, if for some reason you don't want the feature, you don't like it, or you're maybe accidentally erasing things just because in frustration you get mad and you shake your phone and you realize, oh, I just, you know, undid that entire email I was trying to write, you can turn it off in the accessibility settings. If you go into settings, general accessibility, scroll down, you'll find a shake to undo option, and you can toggle that to off, and then shake to undo won't work anymore. So good little tip, and I'm glad that Brian wrote that up, because it's easy to forget these simple little things that have been built into the operating systems for years. Received an email from Russell this week. He's a working photographer, and he said, you know, I need to store a lot of files currently. He manages about 12 terabytes of images, and he's been doing that with various spinning hard drives, traditional hard drives. And he wrote me to say he was considering moving some or a lot of his system possibly to SSD, to solid state drives, to, you know, take advantage of the performance benefits. And he was looking through prices on Amazon and thought he had found a killer deal, a 2 terabyte Seagate SSD 3.5 inch internal drive for just £86. Yeah, I want that deal too, Russell, if you can tell me where to get it. Well, he knew it sounded too good to be true, and he looked it over, looked a little more closely, and realized what was being advertised was actually a solid state hybrid drive. And so he asked me, what's the difference between a solid state drive and a solid state hybrid drive? And Russell, that is an awesome question, because until recently, we really only had two kinds of hard drives, right? We had traditional spinning hard drives, you know, that we are all used to and have used for years and have become incredibly inexpensive or relatively cheap. And then you have the fast, high performance, but very, very pricey solid state drives, the SSD drives, and they tend to be in smaller file sizes. So typically, if you have a lot of archival data storage that you need to store, you end up with HDD or a traditional spinning hard drive. And, you know, for your new computer and operating system and apps and things that you want to go really, really fast, you get a SSD. But then along came this thing called the hybrid solid state drive, or in Apple terms, it's what they call their Fusion drive. And what a hybrid drive is you have a large traditional spinning hard drive volume coupled with a smaller NAND flash SSD drive. And the SSD can vary in size dependent, you know, I've seen everything ranging from 8 gigabytes to about 256 gigabytes. There may be larger ones. But the idea is you have both of these typically in the same enclosure, although I think you can actually build hybrid drives with, you know, drives that are in separate enclosures as well. But typically these all come in a single enclosure. So you've got a traditional spinning hard drive coupled with some amount of NAND flash storage. And then what happens is there's a software layer, either in the OS or I think in some cases in the firmware on the drive, that basically combines these two things into a single logical volume. So when you plug it into your machine, when you install it in your machine, the operating system sees it as one single drive. And then the software also manages the data. And what it does is it will move your most recently accessed or used files onto the faster solid state portion of the drive, onto the SSD portion of the drive, and then it shuffles anything older or that you're not actively working with onto the slower HDD portion. So it's constantly doing this kind of juggling act where it's moving stuff that it thinks or knows you're going to access more frequently onto the fast portion of the drive, the smaller space, and then shuffling everything else off onto the slower storage when it's not needed anymore. So the idea here is it's a great compromise that balances the line between this high-performance, fast SSD storage and the larger storage capacity and price of a traditional hard drive. So the idea would be, hey, you're going to get the best of both worlds here. Now, the main disadvantage versus an SSD is that, yeah, it's faster than a traditional spinning drive, but it's not nearly as fast as a pure SSD drive in actual usage. And I think that's because of some of the overhead of it, you know, juggling and moving things around and stuff like that. Another thing that I haven't heard this written up, but I'd be concerned about with a hybrid drive would be write cycles. SSDs can only be written to so many times, and there's a bunch of technologies that go into sort of managing and making sure that, you know, they don't get written to the same spot over and over again, because that they can actually wear out. There's drive wear that can happen. And so if you have a small SSD and it's constantly writing and moving and writing to the disk, I would wonder if that's going to wear out a little bit faster than, say, a traditional straight, you know, SSD drive. But that said, if you're trying to decide between a traditional spinning hard drive and a solid-state hybrid drive, if that's kind of the thing you're looking at because of price and storage capacity and stuff like that, and they're about the same price, I think at this point I probably opt for the solid-state hybrid drive, because you're going to get a large amount of storage and you're going to get a little bit better performance. Also, if you want some extra performance but just literally can't afford the cost of a solid state drive, it may be an option for you. But if you're looking at a drive and the only thing that you're using it for is long-term storage, if you're not going to be actively working off of it and performance really isn't an issue, I think you can still save money with going with a more traditional drive. But if price is relatively the same for the same storage capacity, unless somebody tells me otherwise, and after the research that I've done, I don't think there's any reason not to go with the solid state hybrid drive. You know, personally, for my money though, I have chosen that I would save my money and actually wait and opt for a true SSD, at least, especially if it's going to be the main drive for your Mac, if it's going to be the boot drive and the drive that you're working off of. A lot of people will go with like a smaller solid state drive, you know, just have two separate drives, a smaller solid state drive, and then just use a traditional hard drive for external storage. And that's kind of what I've done. I lucked out with my latest MacBook Pro because I think I have a 1 terabyte SSD in here. But as those of you who listen to the show know, I got a great deal on that because I had long and ongoing logic board issues with my last model. So Apple gave me a bit of a discount. So I got that at, you know, a steal for that amount of storage. I never would have been able to afford that, nor would I have opted to buy that on its own because of the cost. So I understand SSDs, you know, are still, you know, gig for gig, terabyte for terabyte, you know, very expensive compared with traditional drives. Hybrid drives are attempting to kind of balance between that, and they're pretty good and they're getting better. But, you know, again, SSD is absolutely the best option if you want to go for pure raw performance. And that's where I'd push most people in most cases. So hopefully that explains everything. If you have any thoughts on SSD versus hybrid drive versus traditional spinning hard drives that you want to weigh in on, shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Now, it's not ever so often that I get a question from somebody, and when I try and find the answer, I end up completely stumped. But this past week, Adam sent me a question, and I thought that I was not going to be able to come up with an answer for him. And I was hoping that I would throw it out to the community and you would help, because you always have my back, right? You're where I turn to when I can't find the answers myself. And the issue he was having had to do with sharing live photos. Specifically, he and his wife share a photo library. He says, you know, they both use photos, and he has one photo library and they put all their images into it. And then they also manage a shared photo library that they both have access to. And he more recently enabled iCloud photo library on his main photo library, and he wanted to sync all of that stuff, including the copies of her photos, onto that main library. And so he realized, you know, he was having no trouble bringing in her photos into his library. But when it came to live photos, specifically the new photos that you can take with your iPhone that give you not just the still photo, but the moving live photo, he was having trouble figuring out how to get those from one photo library to another. He realized he could share the live photo from her account using an iCloud shared library, but when he brought that into his library, the resolution was not maintained. So the originals would be at 3024 by 4032. When they came through the iCloud shared library, they wound up at a resolution of 1537 by 2049. So the resolution was reduced. So it worked, but not ideal. He also tried export originals from her library and the Photos app. And when he would bring that in to his library, the live portion was lost. So basically he would get the JPEG portion, but not the motion JPEG layer or the movie file that was coupled with it. A lot of people probably don't know, and I probably should explain this a little bit better. So inside a live photo, you have the standard still photo, and then there's also coupled with it, somehow paired with it in this little, I don't know if it's in a package. I've done a lot of research on this. I still can't find, and maybe this is the question I can ask you. I still can't find the specific details about how these two things are merged together, but there's this movie file. I think it's 15 frames per second video, and I believe it's a motion JPEG video file that's also captured at the same time. It's 1.5 seconds of video that's captured at the same time you take the photo. It's actually a little bit before and a little bit after you take the photo. So I was looking at this, I was researching it, I couldn't find the answer, and then literally as I'm typing out the show notes for the show, one last time I decided, you know, let me go look one last time, let me Google and see if I can find something. And sure enough, a Mac 911 piece from Glenn Fleischman, brilliant man, great writer over at Macworld. I'll have a link to his full article in the show notes at maccast.com. But back in May, he had this exact question. And in his article, he said, if you use the export unmodified original option from the Photos app, or if you hold the option key down while you drag the image out of the Photos application, which is actually doing the export unmodified original. So option dragging a photo out of iPhoto, and I didn't know this until I read this tip, that actually exports the unmodified original file. So if you've made some edits or changes to the file in Photos and you want to export out the original, just hold down the option key. But for live photos, when you do that, either of these methods, what it does is it does export the live photo data. And what you end up with, oddly, and this just adds further to my confusion about how these two things are merged together in the Photos app. When you export the unmodified original of a live photo, what you get on your desktop or in the Finder is actually two individual files. You get the JPEG file and a separate movie file. And so I thought, okay, well, that's great, but now I've got these two files. I can't really go back and tell Adam, oh, yeah, well, you're just going to have a movie file and a separate still image file. And yeah, that doesn't solve the problem, right? Because he wants to get the live photo from one library to another. Well, I thought, let me see what happens if I just drag both of these into my iPhoto library. And something magical happened. What it actually did was it imported them both and actually imported them separately. You know, like in the import area of the Photos app, you see the still image and you see the video image. Yet when you go into the photo library, somehow magically, they're remerged back into a live photo. So that ended up being your answer, Adam. Just do the export unmodified original rather than just export originals, and it should work for you. So found the solution. But I still have the challenge to you of, can someone explain to me what exactly is going on under the hood? I have little bits and pieces of what's going on under the hood in terms of a live photo, but I really still can't find the definitive answer of how does a live photo work. unicorns and magic. It's the world of Apple. I guess that may be the answer. It's simply magic. Okay. Last thing that I have for you today is a question from Susan. She asked me if I could run down the OS X keychain, and more specifically, iCloud keychain, and how all of that works on the Mac and our iOS devices. And I'm in no way an expert on this, but I did a little poking around. I did a little bit of research. And the first thing you need to know, I think, Susan, about the OS X keychain is when we say OS X keychain, we are typically discussing really two or maybe three things within the ecosystem of Apple and OS X and iOS. There is the keychain, the OS X keychain, which is the thing that's stored in Mac OS or in OS X. Then you have iCloud keychain, which is an optional service that you can turn on for synchronizing the data that's in your keychain via iCloud across your Macs and your devices. And then the third piece that kind of comes into play when you start talking about keychain is the actual keychain access application, which you'll find in your applications utilities folder in Mac OS. And that's the thing that you can use to view and manage the items that are in your keychain, both your Mac keychain and your iCloud keychain, the thing that syncs. Now, what most people don't know is that the keychain, you can actually store a number of different things. A lot of people kind of know and understand that the keychain stores your website usernames and passwords in Safari. So if you've ever used Safari to log into a website and it says, hey, do you want to save the username and password for the site? That goes into your keychain. You can also store credit card information. So if you've gone online shopping in Safari and you've checked out, it may ask you if you want to store your credit card information or the autofill information for your contacts. All of that stuff is stored through Safari into the keychain. The keychain also stores things like your Wi-Fi network information and passwords. So, you know, you go to log in at a Wi-Fi hotspot someplace, a friend's house or a restaurant or a place that you've gone, a Starbucks, something like that. That data and information is stored in the keychain. It also stores information for the accounts that you use in mail, contacts, calendars, messages, also internet accounts like Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Basically anything, if you've gone into system preferences and you've gone into internet accounts and added accounts into there, all of that data and information is stored in the Mac's keychain. And if you choose to use iCloud keychain, then all of that data can be synced and those logins and accounts can be synced securely across your iOS devices and your Macs via iCloud. So the keychain is actually pretty secure. It's secured by your OS X login and for iCloud or iOS devices and iCloud keychain by the passcode or the Touch ID fingerprint that is on your device. So it's all encrypted. It's stored. And whenever your device or your Mac is locked, it is protected. When your Mac or device is unlocked, then the system and the apps have access to the items that are in your keychain. So that's how when you're using Safari on your Mac and your Mac's been unlocked after you've logged into it, the keychain is fully unlocked. And now Safari or a third-party app can access the data that it needs inside the keychain, and it can use that. So that's how it autofills your logins or maybe autofills the credit card data when you're doing online shopping. When your Mac or device is locked, again, it's all encrypted and secured. And the data is also encrypted and secured when it's in transmit if you're using iCloud keychain. So when it's being transferred and when it's stored in the cloud, it is 100% encrypted and secure. And what's really nice about the keychain is its integration into the system and into iCloud. It's just easy to use. And most people probably are using the keychain and don't even realize that they're using it, right? Because how many people just say when Safari asks, would you like me to save your username and password? You say yes, right? It goes right in there. It's always accessible on your Mac and your iOS devices. If you're using iCloud syncing, it's just there. So you don't have to worry that I set up that new account and saved my password on my Mac. Now I'm on my iPad. I want to log into the same website. Boom, it's just magically there and it just magically works. That's all the power of the keychain working under the hood. One of the main disadvantages, I think, and maybe one of the only disadvantages of iCloud Keychain or the Keychain, is that it is Mac and iOS only. So if you have other devices, you have an Android device, or you have a Windows machine or a Unix machine or something, or a Linux machine, something like that, you're not going to be able to sync that data across there. So in those instances, you know, a third-party keychain manager, something like LastPass or 1Password, something like that, may be a better solution. And those still may be a better solution because they have a little bit more functionality. They're a little more robust. You know, Apple's is really focused on certain specific kinds of logins and a few bits of other data. I mean, you actually can store secure notes in the keychain and other information if you'd like, but the interface is not as nice. It's a little bit more cumbersome. If you've ever opened up keychain access, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, you sort of understand this. But, you know, because it's built in and integrated into the system, it's very easy to use and set up and to work with. As far as setting up iCloud Keychain, so the keychain itself is just kind of on and there. And anytime, like I said, you choose to save your passwords or save your information, it's happening automatically locally on your device. If you want to sync everything up, then you need to enable iCloud Keychain. And that's also very easy to do. You could do it on your Mac or from your device. And wherever you choose to do it first, the first time it's going to ask you if you want to set up an iCloud security code. So on the Mac, you're going to go into System Preferences, you're going to go into iCloud, and you're going to find the setting for iCloud Keychain. You flip that on, and it'll walk you through the process of setting it up. iOS device is going to be very similar. You're going to go into Settings, into iCloud, and turn on iCloud Keychain. And when you do that, it will ask you, do you want to set up an iCloud security code? This can be a 6-digit code or a more complex alphanumeric code that you set, or the OS X or the setup will also randomly generate one for you if you want. And what the iCloud security code is used for is it's used to authorize additional devices to use your iCloud Keychain, because after the first device, every additional device that you turn on, it's going to ask you to kind of verify that you have that device. And the easiest way to do that is with the iCloud security code. The iCloud security code can also be used to identify your devices in case you need to recover your iCloud keychain because you've lost all of your devices. So it can perform, it kind of verifies your identity as the owner of that iCloud keychain. And it's a little separate number. The key about the security code when you're asked to set it up is do not forget it, because if you misenter it too many times, the iCloud keychain will become unusable. It will lock it. Apple can kind of help verify your identity and maybe get you access back to it again so you can make additional attempts. But if you totally forget it, you're not going to be able to get into your iCloud keychain, and then you're going to have to completely start over and set it up again. Again, not devastating unless you don't know any of your passwords. You're going to have to kind of reset everything, but just don't forget it. When you set up the security code, don't forget it. And so then, like I said, once you've set it up on one device, if you go to activate iCloud Keychain on any additional devices, it's going to, one, request approval from another device that has iCloud Keychain already activated on it. So you get a little pop-up message and you have to say, allow, it's part of the security feature, so that not just anybody can attempt to get into your iCloud Keychain. And then you're going to, if you set it up with the security code, you're going to have to provide that security code to get on there. And if you use two-factor authentication, you can actually turn on iCloud Keychain without having to get approval from another device. You just have to authorize with your two-factor authentication. And if you want to keep the iCloud Keychain off of Apple's servers, so like I said, you sync this through iCloud, and when you're using the iCloud security code, a copy is actually stored, an encrypted copy is actually stored up on Apple's servers in the cloud. If you want to have the syncing turned on, but you don't want Apple to keep a copy of your iCloud keychain, what you can do is skip that iCloud security code step. And in that case, the data is only stored locally on your device, and any updates only happen across your approved devices, but nothing is stored in the cloud. Now, the main disadvantage of doing that is if something does go wrong, Apple's not going to be able to help you recover your iCloud keychain. They don't have a copy of it. It's only locally on your devices. So if you've lost all your devices, there's no way to get your iCloud keychain back. So that's kind of iCloud keychain, how you enable it. Last thing I think I want to mention is the keychain access application, the sort of third piece of this puzzle. Again, it's in Applications Utilities Keychain Access, and it lets you see and manage all of the items that are in your OS X keychain. And you have to authenticate and click a little lock to do some of the actions when you're in there. As far as what you'll see if you open up the application, there are kind of four keychains. I think these are almost really like filters or, you know, views of the keychain data. There are login. There's a login keychain, which has your application passwords, certificates, private and public keys, your airport passwords. There's also the iCloud keychain, which is all of the items that are synced through the iCloud keychain. If you have that turned on, again, there's web passwords in there, applications passwords, airport and network passwords. Again, I saw a lot of overlap when I was looking at these different keychains. The system keychain has certificates and airport passwords, and then there's the system roots, which you really don't have to worry about too much. These are the root certificate authority certificates that are maintained and installed by the system. And then once you're looking at any one of these given keychains, there are also some additional categories you can kind of browse through on the bottom half of the interface. You can look at all of the items that are in a particular keychain, or you can look at just passwords, secure notes, my certificates, keys, and just certificates in general. The one area of note in here, as I mentioned earlier, is the secure notes section. You can actually go under the file menu and you can add a secure note inside the keychain. And inside a note, you can put any information that you'd like. So this would be actually a great place to store any personal data that you want to keep private. So if you want to, you know, write down your credit card numbers or maybe your 1Password password, you could store this in a secure note inside the keychain. Just remember that anytime your Mac or your iOS device is unlocked, somebody would have access to this data and information. That's just how it works. So you always want to make sure that your devices are auto locking, or if you walk away from your Mac or something like that and you're using the keychain, that you have it auto lock or you lock it yourself before you walk away. Now, most of the stuff inside the keychain access app, you really don't need to concern yourself with. It's managed by the system and by your apps. It's kind of fun to poke around in here and look a little bit, but it's really, you know, a lot of it is probably not going to make a lot of sense. And again, you don't really need to worry about it because it's handled by the system. And be careful when you're in here because you can actually delete or modify items that are in here, and you wouldn't necessarily want to delete one of your Safari saved passwords just by accident, right? A lot of people rely on those things being available in Safari when they go to log in. So poke around in here, play. There is one handy thing that you can do with keychain access that I use quite frequently, and that is the ability to select a web password item and choose get info inside the keychain access application. And what you can do from there is there's a handy little checkbox in the info panel that will say show password. And if you check that and then authenticate with your username and password, your admin username and password, it will actually display the password for you. So I've had instances where I'm on a website and I've forgotten the password for some reason. It didn't end up in 1Password, but I had saved it into the keychain. And rather than having to use their forgot password feature, I could just go into keychain access, find that password for that website, and just reveal it for myself and then enter it in, and then I could get right in. You can actually also see Safari passwords, website passwords inside Safari. And a lot of people don't know this. If you go into Safari preferences passwords, there is a show password for selected websites option in that list. So you can filter that list or use the search, find the password or find the website that you're looking for the password for, again, as long as you've saved it into your keychain and you can reveal that password. Another kind of little handy trick that you can use keychain access for is actually generating or creating new passwords. If you go under the file menu, you can actually choose the option to create a new password item. And this will create a new password and save it in the keychain. It will ask for a couple bits of information. If it's an internet password for the item name, you want to put in the URL or the site of the website that you're adding a password for. In the account name section, that is going to be your login name. So in many cases, that'll be like an email address or whatever username you're going to use to log into that website. And then you can generate a password from here. If you click the little key icon, so you could just type in a password if you know the password you want to use. But a better thing to do would be to generate a random secure password. And you could do that by clicking the little key icon to get the password assistant window. And then from there, it will let you generate the password. It will even show you the quality of that password, how secure it is. And it gives you some options. You can select different types of passwords, like a memorable one, or one that uses just letters and numbers, or numbers only, or a completely random one. And there's also a little slider to set the length of that randomly generated password. So you can generate it right there inside Keychain Access, and then have that save that password into your Keychain and into the iCloud Keychain so that it syncs to your other devices. It's basically the same as, you know, it's a more manual way of doing the same thing that happens when you go to the website, you generate a password, and you have Safari save it for you, right? You can do it directly in the Keychain Access application. And so that, in a nutshell, is OS X Keychain or iCloud Keychain. And I hope that helps answer your question, Susan. One last thing to mention. I mentioned how you can look at your Safari passwords in Safari on the Mac. You could actually also do that on iOS. The way that you do it in iOS is you go into Settings, Safari, Passwords, and then you can view all of your saved Safari passwords there. And as a matter of fact, you can also edit and add new passwords into Safari and the Keychain from there as well. Just scroll all the way to the bottom if you'd like to add a new password, or click on any one of the passwords to edit it. And again, it will ask you to authenticate before you get into the passwords, either with your iOS login or your Touch ID. But once you're in there, you'll be able to view and see all of the saved passwords that are part of the iCloud Keychain. So that's it. I think that's all I have for you this week. A little bit longer show, but like I said at the top, we had a lot to talk about. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show's sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details, and also that 20% off of PDF Pen Pro by going to smilesoftware.com/maccast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can always send me audio comments or email. Send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or if you're on Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plus/MacCast, and that's the plus symbol. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.